Hello, it's John Dennis on Tuesday the 11th of August. Today, controversy as Baby P's mother, the woman who caused his death, is named.
The law is murky, but as a matter of policy, I'm not convinced, really for the sake of her children, that it's a brilliant idea to publish the name of the mother.
Also today, the bloody death toll on the streets of Barack Obama's adopted hometown of Chicago.
We have 7-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 3-year-olds who are dying by violence. The kind of child that creates, we liken to a child warrior.
And Peter Mandelson's first full day running number 10 while Gordon Brown's on holiday.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's Bill Overton with the news and a look at the papers.
Following the expiry of a court order, the couple responsible for the death of baby P have been identified. 17-month-old Peter Connolly died at the hands of Tracy Connolly and her lover Stephen Barker in August 2007. He'd suffered 50 injuries, including fractured ribs and a broken back. Doctors, social workers and police failed to save the youngster, despite him being on the Haringey Council Child Protection Register. After the trio's trial at the Old Bailey last November, there was public outrage at the way the toddler was let down by the authorities. It's also been disclosed today that the third defendant in the case, Jason Owen, is Barker's brother. We'll have more on this later in Guardian Daily. A huge landslide in China has toppled 7 apartment buildings. The devastation in the eastern Zhejiang province has been caused by Typhoon Morikot. The 3-story blocks were at the foot of a mountain. And in Taiwan, a mudslide caused by the heavy rains has buried a remote mountain village, leaving at least 400 people unaccounted for. Alcohol is being blamed for an alarming rise in oral cancers. The number of 40-somethings developing problems in the mouth, tongue, lip and throat have increased by a quarter in the past decade. This is according to Cancer Research UK. Smoking and alcohol consumption are the two main risk factors. But since cancers caused by cigarettes often take up to 30 years to develop, tobacco is not thought to be the main culprit. Alcohol consumption's doubled in the UK since the 50s. Andrew Flintoff's set to be fit for the deciding Ashes test at the Oval. The England all-rounder's received positive news about his troublesome right knee after seeing a specialist in London yesterday. Flintoff was left out of the fourth test at Headingley because of concerns he wouldn't last the 5 days. His inclusion for next week's match will impact on the current debate over whether to call out batsmen Robert Key, Mark Ramprakash or Jonathan Trott. Unsurprisingly, many of the papers feature unflattering pictures of the mother of baby P on their front pages today. The Mail says the woman who coldly stood by and watched her son tortured to death has been unmasked. The Times says out of the darkness, they've been named at last. According to the Telegraph, the killers will be given new identities at taxpayers' expense and lifetime protection from the threat of public exposure. All 3 defendants are pictured in the Mirror with the simple headline, Monsters. Some of the other stories around. The Times says the government's plan to shelve supermarket 2-for-1 food deals to reduce Britain's food waste mountain. The Independent reports on the hunt for a missing cargo ship, thought to be the first hijacked vessel to be sailed through the English Channel in modern times. The Mail says scientists are developing a cure for cancer based on bee stings. Finally, former England defender Sol Campbell could be on his way to join Sven-Göran Eriksson at League 2 side Notts County. That's according to The Star. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
The identity of Baby P's mother was revealed last night after a court order protecting her anonymity expired. She's Tracy Connolly, and Baby P's full name can be revealed as Peter Connolly. His mother, Tracy, and her boyfriend, Stephen Barker, were responsible for his death. A third defendant in the case can be named as 37-year-old Jason Owen, Barker's brother. Peter died in August 2007 after suffering 50 injuries, including a broken back. Doctors, social workers and the police failed to save Peter, even though he was on Haringey Council's Child Protection Register. Roger Smith is the director of the law reform and human rights organisation Justice.
I think I have 2 reactions. One, as a lawyer, I think the law is murky. And as someone concerned with the policy in a case like this, I'm not actually convinced that it's in the best interests of all concerned, particularly the siblings of baby P, that the name of the mother be released.
But this is a serious crime, and surely a perpetrator loses any right to anonymity.
Absolutely right. And as a question of basic policy and indeed basic law, names of those who found guilty or plead guilty in the court should be published. Absolutely right. And then there's a question of, well, are there any exceptions to that? Now, one which has applied in this case, which no longer does, is where there are subsequent proceedings. Difficult thing in this case is that baby, and we don't know enough, really, but baby P had siblings. And that, I think, raises really serious issues about what we think about publicizing children's names. And there's a third issue, which is there is a horrible bloodlust up about this case and the mother's role. I mean, it really sort of is quite frightening if you go on the internet and read some of the stuff which has been written about her and the sort of chance of vigilante and vigilantism and so on. And I think there's a really unpleasant taste to that, which I don't think is going to be assuaged by publishing her name. I think that's going to accelerate death threats to her and all the rest of it. So the law is murky, and but as a matter of policy, I'm not convinced, really for the sake of her children, and secondly for the sake of her own safety, that it's a brilliant idea to publish the name of the mother.
Roger Smith. Well, not everyone agrees. Here's Neri Shan from the law firm Taylor Wessing.
I'm surprised that no one on behalf of Baby P's mother has tried to get a more permanent anonymity order on the basis that her life may be seriously at risk. But in the absence of any such application, in the absence of compelling evidence that her life would be at risk if she was named, I don't find it surprising that the anonymity order is being lifted, because anonymity orders should only be imposed in exceptional circumstances.
What about the argument that the lifting of the anonymity order endangers Baby P's siblings?
Again, I think there needs to be compelling evidence of that if the court is going to consider that argument. At first blush, I can't see that that would be the case. But I think in the absence of any evidence of that, then I think that it's right and proper that she should be named. I think the general rule is that, especially if you're talking about an adult rather than a child that's committed a serious crime, that you should be accountable for what you've done. And therefore, it is right that she be named and the anonymity order is lifted.
Neri Shan, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/society. Also on The Guardian's website, as the Welsh Assembly announces plans to impose charges for plastic bags in all shops, Leo Hickman explains why the issue is dividing environmentalists. guardian.co.uk/environment. Amin Saina on why actors lie about their age. guardian.co.uk/theatre. And Jonathan Franklin reports on the cocaine bars springing up in Bolivia. guardian.co.uk/G2. In Chicago, 42 children have been killed violently in the last year. Many of the killings have involved guns and have taken place in the city's poor and overwhelmingly black South Side. 14 have died within walking distance of President Barack Obama's family home. Philip Jackson is the director of the Black Star Project, an educational program for young black people. He spoke to The Guardian's Ed Pilkington.
We found out some very interesting things. Not only did we plot out where the murders are happening, then we said, well, wait a minute, doesn't the president live somewhere in this area? We saw that many of the murders were within walking distance of his house. Where he lives, that you could walk to where the murders are taking place. And then we kept plotting, and we found out that 75% of the murders, 75% were within 8 miles of his house. But then we said, well, wait a minute. What about this? Look, there are no murders here. There's not one murder. And we discovered that this is where most of the white Chicagoans live. They're living in a whole nother America versus where the black Chicagoans live. We have 7-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 3-year-olds who are dying by violence. The kind of child that creates, we liken to a child warrior. The kind of child warriors you see in underdeveloped countries who basically don't have a conscience, don't have feelings. All they know is war. We're saying that if President Obama nodded and said, I don't want this happening in Chicago, that's all he would have to say. He doesn't have to come here. He doesn't have to get involved. His people will figure out a way to stop this. That's all he's got to say. We can't get him to say that.
Willa and Juan Pitts, know all about the terrible impact that a child's death has on a family. Earlier this year, they lost not one, but two sons to the violence, Kendrick, aged 17, and Carnell, 18. The boys, who they had adopted, were shot 2 weeks apart.
Kendrick was shot in the head. He was shot up about seven times. So when the gun violence took place, Carnell ran and got on a bus. As the bus drove by, he saw Kendrick laid out on the ground with blood. They ran behind him, shooting him up, shot him in his back. And I'm quite sure they shot him in the front too, because when he approached, that's when they opened fire. Actually, the day that Carnell was killed was the day they had just cremated Kendrick, and his death certificate had came in the mail.
And you're fairly convinced it was to stop him being a witness?
Yes. A couple of days after Kendrick was murdered, I know he couldn't eat, he couldn't sleep, and he said that they had put a room on the street, that he would be next.
At the side of a road in a run-down Southside neighbourhood, there's a striking memorial. It's a shed full of paving stones, each one with the name on it of a child that has been killed. It was started 2 years ago by a community group called Kids Off the Block, or KOB, that tries to help teenagers stay out of trouble.
We started off with about six stones after Blair Holt got killed, and now we are up to 153, and we should be to 161. Most of the people, they scared of the summer because of so much killing and shooting, violence. When it gets hot, the gangbangers want to come out, the shooters want to come out. I know little 11 and 12-year-olds who got two and three guns. I'm not talking about no big, like, Deuce 5, nothing like that. I'm talking about big AKs and techs and stuff like that.
The most dramatic attempt to stem the violence are the so-called interrupters. These are young men who have had themselves a history of gang membership and violence, so they know what they're talking about. But they've emerged reformed characters. Through a Chicago group called, appropriately, Ceasefire, they then go back onto the streets that they used to frequent and try to persuade new gang members that it simply isn't worth it.
The crossing over point, I guess, is different for everybody. Ours, mine was, you know, just kind of tired of the lifestyle.
Ed Pilkington reporting. My name's John Dennis. This is Guardian Daily. Still to come, holidaymakers are being warned to stay away from some of Brittany's most popular beaches because of a toxic seaweed.
Local authorities are saying, don't panic, not the whole Brittany region is in danger of this. But you do have to be very careful if you see this weed.
But first, Daniel Fitzsimons, a British security contractor, could become the first Westerner to face a murder trial in Iraq. He could face the death penalty. He's suspected of shooting dead Paul McGuigan, a Briton with family in the Peebles area of Scotland, and Darren Hoare, an Australian. Martin Chulov is in Baghdad for The Guardian.
It appears that around 2:30 on Sunday morning, one of the compounds in the green zone, three guys got an argument, and it appears also that beers were involved, and things deteriorated very quickly, to the extent that one of the guys, British national Daniel Fitzsimon, allegedly pulled a pistol and shot dead two of his colleagues before running through the compound and shooting an Iraqi, and then being captured by the Americans and handed over to the Iraqis, where he faces a very bleak future indeed.
Indeed, he could be the first Westerner to be charged with murder and face a murder trial in Iraq.
Indeed, that's right, and he is in very uncharted territory at the moment. This is something that the Iraqi government has been pledging for many months now. They've been quite unhappy with the presence of Western security contractors in Iraq after the Americans had basically pulled back to their bases within the cities and had been saying that it was high time that they were held to account by the Iraqi government. Now, they make no secret of the fact that they would like these companies to scale back their presence in Iraq, and they make no secret also the fact that they do have a very different justice system with, I guess, fewer means of redress than we're used to in Western societies. So the accused man at the moment is facing a very uncertain future indeed.
He could face the death penalty.
Yes, he could. And the Iraqis have insisted today that they are of a mind to push for it. Now, Iraqi justice post the occupation really is still taking shape. And there are quite a few variables and quite a few steps that could be taken before it got to the gallows. But that is very much on the table at the moment, and it's something that's been stressed today by the Iraqi Justice Minister.
What kind of questions are asked of potential security workers before these firms send people to work in the green zone in Baghdad?
There's been, I think it's fair to say, a gradual slide in the standard of people that are operating in Baghdad. In the early days, in just following the invasion, the private security contractors were comprised largely of ex-special forces people from the British, American, Australian, New Zealand special forces. Now, as the private security industry in Baghdad expanded, a lot of other people came in. There were people from regular military units, and then there was a third tier as well. And a lot of these guys had been doormen in pubs in England and in Ireland or Sydney or Auckland, and some of them also had been South African mercenaries and people from third world countries. So there are some mixed standards and mixed levels of experience there, and there really isn't a great deal of consistency amongst the security fraternity.
Martin Chulov. He used to be known as the Prince of Darkness, but in an interview with The Guardian, Peter Mandelson insists he's now a kindly pussycat. Gordon Brown's business secretary, his former bitter enemy of course, sealed his political comeback this week as he sits in for the Prime Minister, who's on holiday. In our Westminster office, Allegra Stratton.
He is having a week, and then we have Alistair Darling taking over after that, and then Jack Straw. And he's determinedly departmental, so he's come back and he's already told reporters at Gatwick Airport, I'm not in charge, even though, well, it's difficult to know. I mean, they're calling them duty ministers, so they're just around in case something happens. And it certainly seems to sort of, the menu of things he's going to do this week are pretty much business focused, apart from something on education. So yeah, he's powerful. He's Peter Mandelson, for God's sake. You know, he did an interview with us and he was tickling everybody's bellies about exactly, you know, his regrets of the past and his ambitions for the future. And so he does play with us. He does like to create the idea that possibly there's further ambitions than simply being First Secretary of State, this preposterous title that Gordon Brown gave him recently. But you know, this summer there's been these stories of PM for PM, Peter Mandelson for PM. I mean, it just couldn't happen.
But yet, you know, no one would have predicted that he would have come this far. You know, no one would have predicted he would have had any sort of political comeback.
Indeed. But he's fantastic as, you know, a sidekick, fantastic as someone who, in contrast with Gordon Brown, he gets away with it because the person in charge has suffered in the popularity stakes so much over the last 2 years. But if it was really, you know, Peter Mandelson on his own, then all those enemies in the past that, okay, recently he said that he's learned not to make so many enemies and learned to patch things up. But really, there's such a proportion of the party that really can't stomach him. Now, we have also seen recently policy sort of olive branches to get my foliage metaphor right. But we've seen him say things about, you know, on access to universities, poorer students should be given a foot up. Lots of things that the left of the party might find quite appealing. Is that personal ambition? He is sort of smoothing the way for his own rise to the top. No way.
Now, Gordon Brown may be doing a bit of ruminating himself. He's on holiday this week. Do we know what kind of a vacation or staycation, as I suspect we need to call this, what is being enjoyed by the Prime Minister?
He used to in his youth and before he became PM, he used to go to Cape Cod and read lots of books and play tennis with Larry Summers. And he's not letting himself do that because of, you know, the interest of the British tourism. So now he's, I think one holiday he went away to Suffolk and apparently he had a fitness trainer get him into shape ahead of party conference. We don't know. They haven't told us anything about what he's up to this week. We had rumours that he was doing community service at some point. Great idea, but they now won't confirm whether he's done this yet or is due to do it later or what. What we know is he's disappeared off the Lake District and I imagine there will be books and quite a lot of BlackBerry and mobile phone action and an attempt by Sarah to make him relax, and she may even be successful.
Allegra Stratton. A killer algae has resulted in the closure of a beach in Brittany. Nitrites used by farmers have polluted the water supply and sent green seaweed spreading across the coast. And when it rots, it emits foul-smelling fumes that can kill in minutes. Now tourists have been warned to stay away from other beaches in northern France. With the details, in Paris, is The Guardian's Angélique Chrysaphis.
Well, certain northern beaches in Brittany have been swamped by tons of potentially lethal rotting green algae. It's known as the green menace. That's been washing up for a number of years now, but the levels are really high. The piles of it are really increasing in tons. And there was a recent case earlier this month which really shocked people in Brittany, where there was a young vet, he was 27, and he was just going along for a horse ride along the beach, not really minding this green algae at all, until his horse slipped in it, collapsed, and actually died within minutes. And he himself fell unconscious and was sort of rescued from the sludge, and only because of that survived. And basically the autopsy has seemed to point out that the noxious fumes from the seaweed was to blame.
And so now this beach has been closed, and what about the rest of the coastline in Brittany?
Well, you've got to remember that Brittany is one of the most popular destinations for holidaymakers in France. Now, we're talking about an area of the Côte d'Amour, so just west of Saint-Malo, and there's been about 70 beaches that have been hit by seaweed. Now, local authorities are saying, don't panic, not the whole Brittany region is in danger of this, but you do have to be very careful if you see this weed, and a lot of locals are avoiding the beaches as well, and they say that the beaches have changed really over the last few years, because you can no longer build sandcastles or go for a dip when you're talking about piles of stinking, it smells like rotting eggs, sort of these masses of stinking algae that the local authorities are trying to clear.
It's a huge blow to the French tourism industry.
Well, it is. Now, environmentalists say that there's a very specific reason for this seaweed, and they want that addressed. They're blaming intensive agriculture and intensive farming in Brittany. Now, there's a lot of pig farming, cow farming and poultry farming, and they're saying that nitrates from this farming are entering the water system, and these are feeding the algae, which is then being washed into shore. So tourists are really staying away from beaches that smell, as well as areas inland that smell because of pig farms. And the environmentalists are saying if you want to change that, you're going to have to address this farming issue.
And what are the French farmers saying?
Well, of course, French farmers are saying that they've been making a lot of effort over nitrates anyway. Local authorities now, they're not saying exactly that the horse has been killed by seaweed. They're staying quiet at the moment. But it's the local mayors that are really trying to fight this. And some of them are spending over €100,000 a year to bulldoze these piles of seaweed away. It's going to take a long time to change this. But environmentalists say you've really got to crack down on the farmers because it's their fault.
Angélique Chrysaphis. Phil Maynard and Andy Duckworth were the producers of today's edition of Guardian Daily, and I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.